Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides on The Naturalist Show on the air. My co-host Carol isn't with us today. She's busy working on her book, and she has a new teaching gig, so she's pretty busy. But today I have a terrific special guest, and his name is Paul Greenberg. Paul, say hi to everybody.
Hey, everybody.
Okay. Paul is an author, and the thing that how I met Paul was I went to a lecture at the Hudson River Foundation, which has a series of lectures once a month. And it's always on the waters, on the seas, on the New York Harbor, and all kinds of stuff. So Paul came, and he gave a great talk on his new book. Is there another book coming along, Paul, in the works?
There is another book coming along.
Okay. Can you tell us anything about it, or too soon?
Well, you know, so this book is called Four Fish, and it's really looks at the sort of global situation of seafood, and I traveled a lot around the world to do it. But I got a little tired of traveling, and also I got to thinking more intensely about the fish that's right in front of us. So the next book is going to be called The Fish Next Door.
The local fish.
And it's really about local fish, and it's really about, you know, is there a solution to have local fish back in our lives?
Oh, terrific. Okay, so as Paul said, his book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And he basically deals with four species, the salmon, the tuna, the bass, and we'll talk about that name, bass, and the cod, right? So let's start off, Paul, and talk about the salmon, because, you know, salmon's really a popular seafood.
It is.
In spite of the fact that there are no wild ones left in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah. Well, so just to, you know, to frame it, you know, the four fish that I chose really were based upon the kind of flesh archetypes that I noticed people tended to want to eat when they go to a supermarket or when they go to a seafood restaurant. You know, people always want to have something sort of pink and succulent. That's your salmon. Right. They'd like to have something white and flaky, which is your cod. Something more substantial they could broil, that's your bass. And finally, something they could steak up our sushi, and that's your tuna. But so I started with salmon, though, because in a way, salmon is the first fish we had really serious problems with as a species.
The population declining.
Well, yeah. I mean, salmon used to be really right there in front of us. As you pointed out at the intro, you know, the Atlantic used to be a very good place for Atlantic salmon, and the only species of salmon that we have in the Atlantic is the Atlantic salmon. And there were, in fact, Atlantic salmon pretty near to New York City, where we are right now. The Connecticut River, the Housatonic River, had active runs of wild salmon. But we lost those runs of salmon in the 1600s and 1700s, and have progressively replaced them with a farm variant. The main thing, though, was that, you know, that I felt kind of defined our relationship with the ocean, the way that salmon works, is that, you know, humans never are very good when they have something very abundant right at their feet.
Right. We just go to town on it and
And go to town on the environment that supports it.
Right.
You know, the main thing that really affects salmon is dams.
Right.
Salmon have to, they spawn in little streams and rivers, and actually quite small streams. And then they head downstream to the larger rivers and go out to sea, and then they come back 3 or 4 years later and try and spawn again. But what happened in colonial times is that, say like the Connecticut River, is that tributary by tributary, we blocked off from spawning. To the point where we had, and these initial dams that were done were for very mundane reasons. Sometimes they were to power a mill. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were to make an ice pond, like before refrigeration.
Oh, sure. It was a central industry.
Exactly. And so if you dammed up your river and made a little pond and it froze and you harvested the ice, you could keep all summer. That was an active income source. Well, the thing is, you know, once upon a time when people arrived in Connecticut, it was just, you know, a watery paradise with all sorts of rivulets here. So you dam one here, you dam one there. Who cares? Well, now, today, we have 5,000 dams in the state of Connecticut.
That many are still left there.
In the state of Connecticut alone.
Some of them are little teeny tiny ones.
Some of them are tiny, but they're large enough to prevent fish passage.
Right.
So if you look at all up and down the East Coast, not just on the American side of the Atlantic, but on the European side, you know, water courses that should be free and should be free flowing have been dammed up. The other thing, though, that you know also affected salmon was overfishing. It turns out, so you know, salmon, Atlantic salmon anyway, they evolved actually in a tiny river system in Azurias in Spain, and then they radiated out and colonized rivers on both sides of the Atlantic. But one of the things they all still do is all Atlantic salmon converge on one little spot off of Greenland to feed.
Right. They all hang out together there.
They all hang out together. It's kind of like a social club.
It's the amazing thing that they can find their way back.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Right. No GPS, no nothing.
No nothing. Well, you know, and in fact, actually, they use their sense of smell.
Right. They're patterned. Well, how would you say?
They imprint. They're imprinted on their home river.
You know, the eels do the same thing in Sargasso, right?
Absolutely.
European eels and the North American.
Although
eels.
The eels go the other way. You know, eels spawn in the ocean and then
the
go back to the rivers to grow to maturity. Well, anyway, so we had this gradual decline of little rivers all throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe. But then what happened is just after World War II. A very small group of fishermen from the Faroe Islands found the little spot off Greenland where all the world's Atlantic salmon went to feed. And they fished it, and they fished it really hard. So, you know, you see, in addition to these sort of gradual hatcheting off of spawning habitat, you see this major decline event that happens in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Interestingly, though, I just got an email from a colleague who is involved in buying out the netsmen in Norway and Scotland and so forth. And
the commercial fishermen.
The commercial fishermen. To the point, you know, I should point out, so now Atlantic salmon is commercially extinct.
Right.
It is not worth it to go fishing. So anytime you go to a supermarket and you see Atlantic salmon on the menu, it's farmed.
It's all farmed.
It's all farmed.
No matter if it comes from Norway.
That's right.
Or Canada.
That's right.
Or Chile.
That's right. It is all, and in fact, Chile, you know, salmon didn't even exist
in the southern hemisphere,
in the south of the equator, because you know the equator acts as a thermal barrier,
right.
So fish couldn't migrate there. Now there are more Atlantic salmon grown in Chile than exist in the entire world, in the entire wild world of salmon.
Yeah, they have this whole fjord system like Norway.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks exactly like Norway.
Deep, cold, clear, hopefully unpolluted water.
That's right. I mean, it's actually quite, I spent a lot of time in Chile, and it's quite beautiful, but it's very strange, you know, to see, wander down to the fjord, and then, what are you doing here, you Atlantic salmon, you know, in the Pacific at the bottom of the world? But just for consumers to understand, when they hear the word wild salmon, the phrase wild salmon, there are wild salmon in the world. There's still quite a few of them, but they're all from the Pacific at this point.
Pacific, Alaska, and the Bering Sea and up that way.
That's right. And just as, you know, salmon in the Atlantic use Greenland as their sort of convergence point, it's the Bering Sea that salmon from the Soviet, or the Russian Far East and the American West converge on that little very fertile portion of the ocean. So the five species of commercial wild salmon that we have left are Chinook or King, Sockeye, Chum, Pink, and Coho. And you'll see all five of those in the market. At this point.
Yeah, is the Arctic char in any way related to the salmon?
It's just a salmonid. It's in the salmon.
It has that same color.
Yeah, so Arctic char is in the family Salmonidae.
Salmonidae, okay.
As are trout, all trout.
Right.
All trout, salmon, chars, they're all pretty closely related. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you as a fisherman, Bernie, you understand, like, those of us who fish and see what they look like, you're like, oh, I know what you're related to.
I know your cousin.
I know your cousin. I ate him, in fact. But, I mean, it's funny, actually, because there's a great I used to work in Russia, and I speak Russian, and there's a great Russian expression, which is «Рыбак рыбака видит издалека», which means a fisherman can spot another fisherman from far away. And amongst the brethren, or the brotherhood, sisterhood of fishermen, fisher people, we know that a char is kind of like a salmon. The rest of the eating public really doesn't know this at all. And to them, a char could be as more, you know, could be a cod.
Anything, right.
So it's interesting all that. But that's another story. Anyway, so what I go into in my book, though, is this urge of humanity to replace wild fish with farmed fish. And so in addition to looking into the decline of the wild situation, I look at the rise of farming, which came out of a very extensive Norwegian experiment in selective breeding. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as salmon started to decline, prices go up. And at a certain point, it's worth it to try and farm something, even if though there are large technical hurdles to overcome. Mm-hmm. And people, what they found is that in Norway, there were 40 extant river systems that had salmon in them, and they each had different traits. And, you know, sort of like any selective breeding program, if you have a lot of genetic material to work with, you can make tremendous strides. And so they ended up selectively breeding Atlantic salmon to the point where they now grow twice as fast as... you know, the original wild Atlantic salmon.
Wow. So they're salmon, but they're not wild salmon anymore.
No.
They've been doctored or genetically...
You know, there's a fine line between...
breeding.
I mean, here's the deal. They're selectively bred. I mean,
right.
Which is not...
We've been doing that for thousands of
years. For a thousand years, for 10,000 years.
Dogs and cattle. And
exactly. Like, we wouldn't have breeds of dogs.
And even women, I think, in some places.
Right. As engineered by the fashion industry.
Right.
It's true. There's a New Yorker cartoon in that. It's like I'm not having sex with you. I'm selectively breeding.
Right. That's good. When I was single, I never heard that one.
Yeah, right? But anyway, you know, so the selective breeding was, you know, a very important aspect of salmon. And we do have this more efficient fish, which in a way is better for the world to have some, you know, an animal that doesn't require as much food to get to market. On the other hand, once you start... creating a subset population that lives alongside the wild population, you have all these problems of potentially, you know, genetic contamination. And I want to emphasize, these are not genetically modified fish. They are selectively bred
fish. Selectively bred, okay.
But it'd be sort of like, what if you went in to the Wild West and, you know, instead of introducing cattle, what if we just decided to find the fastest, fattiest buffalo, fastest growing, fattiest buffalo, and then we started growing them. But then... they started escaping and interbreeding with the population. You're going to shift the the genetics of the overall population, which can contribute to, you know, the weakening of the genome of that species.
It could be pluses or minuses.
There could be pluses or minuses,
you get a faster growing fish. But as you say, it could be a problem with the genome, subject to diseases or things
right.
like that.
I mean, generally, people who've watched salmon, what they worry is that, you know, with these farm salmon is that they tend to put on weight really quickly. They outcompete wild fish at the early stage, you know, so that they'll displace them at the early stage. But then when they reach maturity, they don't really have the wherewithal to breed. So in other words, you've basically effectively sterilized a salmon population. Now, there are, though, the next thing on the horizon is, in fact, a genetically modified salmon, and that's the next step. You know, you know, where scientists are always going with fish is to make them more efficient, and so we already have this selectively bred Atlantic salmon that grows twice as fast as the wild fish. What a company called Aqua Bounty has done is they've taken the already twice as fast growing fish, spliced a growth gene from a western from a Pacific salmon, a Chinook salmon, into their genome, and then used a regulator protein from a fish called an ocean pout, which they fiddled around with in an early iteration and figured out where the on and off gene, the on and off switch
switches
is. And they took this on and off switch from the pout, put it onto the Chinook, put it on, and stuck it in the Atlantic. And then you have a fish that grows twice as fast as the already twice as fast growing.
Okay, so it's a super salmon.
It's you know, they call it it's got a trademark. It's called the AQ Advantage Salmon, TM.
That's like patenting genes when those guys first started out.
Yep. And in fact, that's what it's all about. Yeah. Because, you know, the people, Aqua Bounty, the people who created this fish, they're not salmon farmers. They don't, you know, they're not going to open salmon farms all over the place. What they want to do is own the genome.
The genome, right.
So they can sell eggs to the many salmon farmers that there are in the world, kind of like Monsanto sells
same
seed.
Same thing with corn.
Yeah, exactly.
And rice.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, Monsanto got a lot of flack for that because they would go around and check the fields, and the guy was growing their corn, right? And if he didn't have whatever...
Yep, get a ticket.
They would want to close them down. So,
yeah.
they had, you know, corn police.
Yeah, I mean, and
so that's what's happening.
That you know, so far it hasn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. There's been very significant opposition. I think there is still time to block the fish, and I actually think there's really no reason for this fish to be introduced because, you know, salmon farming as it is right now, they already have figured out how to grow a fish fast enough without genetically modifying it to grow it in containment, and this is a key point.
Containment, not in those nets in the bay.
Not in the nets in the bay. That's the big
problem. That's the problem.
Yeah, the big problem with salmon farms is if you put them in the bay, they, you know, expose wild salmon to things like sea lice, which is an ectoparasite that can cause weakening of wild stocks. Various things like nutrification of the bay can happen where algal blooms happen, and then you create a little mini dead zone. If you grow fish in containment, though, you keep the wild the farm separate from the wild. Aqua Bounty, the one positive thing of Aqua Bounty is that they want to grow their fish in containment. And they argue that they need a genetically modified fish because containment systems are so energy intensive.
Yeah, they're expensive.
And they're expensive so that you really need to move a lot of fish quickly through them.
Right, speed up the production line.
Exactly.
I mean, like a Charlie Chaplin. Remember that old film?
Yeah.
Modern times, and now you're going to see what salmon goes.
That's right. Well, I mean, whatever. However you feel about farmed fish, containment, in my opinion, is the better way to go.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But there already are a few different companies that have managed to grow salmon in containment, making a little bit of profit. And the Arctic Char, which you spoke of earlier, also actually works pretty well in containment. You know why? Because Arctic Char, just that they're Arctic.
They're Arctic, okay.
And what this means is that they are often in ecosystems where the lake that they're in can freeze nearly solid.
Okay.
And they get crowded together. And so they've developed very high disease resistance and a tolerance for close conditions. So you can grow Arctic char in containment.
Mm-hmm.
They seem almost naturally...
They don't mind being crowded.
They don't mind being crowded. And so if you have a fish like an Arctic char that tastes pretty salmon-like, I quite like Arctic char.
Yeah, it's very nice.
And you've got that fish that already, without any genetic modification, seems to work. Why would we want to even risk introducing a genetically modified fish? It just doesn't seem to make sense.
Because
you can make more money.
Right. I mean, that's corporate.
That's right.
That's our society. That's what it is.
That's right.
So we just have to be careful that we don't screw it all up.
That's right.
Again.
That's right.
All right.
My last sort of end note on this is that, you know, while we have lost a lot of salmon in the Atlantic, we do still have very viable runs of salmon in the Pacific.
In the Pacific, right.
But again, a big struggle's coming up. You know, recently the New York Times asked me to do something for their food issue. They asked, you know, is there a guilt-free fish that I can eat? And I chose the Bristol Bay, Alaska sockeye salmon because this is the largest run of sockeye left in the world, 40 million fish annually. But we send half of it abroad, which is crazy because it's the great source of omega-3s. But the other thing is that there's a large consortium called the Pebble Partnership that is trying to put a copper mine right at the headwaters of this.
That's all we need.
Exactly. And
like Mitsubishi.
Well, and in fact, Mitsubishi was a partner in this.
Right.
So copper in concentrations of 2 parts per billion is enough to throw off a salmon's migration route. So you could see why copper is not a great idea for a salmon run.
Okay. I liked reading your thing about the Yukon River.
Yeah, well, fantastic place. Great salmon.
I was up there a couple of years ago.
Oh, really?
And actually canoed on it for a little distance.
All right.
Just to say, I canoed on the Yukon, you know what I mean? But it wasn't... We didn't do any fishing on it.
Yeah.
But we did... Jack, what do we have? About 30 seconds left? Okay. We did see local folks, sustainable fishermen.
Yep.
Who were allowed to catch stuff.
Yep.
And they were using these fishing wheels. Did
yep.
you see those fishing
uh-huh.
wheels? It's amazing. It's like a carousel. It's like a Ferris wheel.
Yep.
And they had these big, beautiful salmon.
Yep.
And we came up to them. I was with a group. We were traveling. And I said, can we buy one for our group? He says, I'm not allowed to sell it to you. He said, but I'll give it to you. You know, they're catching so many. And here it was. It must have been a 10-pound salmon. It was beautiful. So we had enough for our whole group. We were a group of 12 traveling in a van.
Yep.
So that's what we had for dinner that night. It was great.
Yep.
Yeah. Salmon is the king of fish to me. Really, it still is. Okay, so we're going to stop for a minute and take a break. And when we come back, Paul, let's move to the... which one do you want to do next?
Let's do the sea bass.
The sea bass next? Okay, now remember the sea bass. That word bass, it's an interesting word because you may think you know what a bass is, but It has a lot of different names. So we'll be back in a minute. Paul Greenberg and Bernie Wides, the naturalist. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, and part two of our show about fish today, and interviewing Paul Greenberg, who wrote this terrific book that I really loved, being a fellow fisherman, called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And in the first half of the show, we spoke about salmon and what's happening to that. I call it an industry, because it's really industry now, right? Mm-hmm. And the next fish we're going to talk about is a sea bass. So, Paul, tell us about this name, sea bass, because it has a lot of different names wherever you go.
Yep.
Right? So the general sea bass is a kind of a fish, like a family.
Well, first of all, you know, I remember there's a guy named Joe Nelson who is considered the sort of major taxonomist of fish in the world, and I interviewed him. And he said to me, you know, the problem is you have taxonomy, which is a science and, you know, very careful science on the one hand. And then you have the way that people name things.
Oh, sure.
Which is very arbitrary.
Common names.
And very weird. And so in trying to reconstruct and figure out what is a bass itself, I found myself in a funny situation of being, you know, on the one hand, an angler who had a certain attraction to this word bass.
Right.
On the other hand, I had to look to scientific taxonomists like Joe Nelson. But then I found myself talking to linguists, one great guy named Anatoly Lieberman, who's considered, you know, one of the great experts on word origins. And he told me a sort of funny thing, which is that early humans tended to have two names for a creature. They would have its common name that they would speak in public, and then there was a private name that you would never speak in public. And so that's why there's already a dichotomy built. You know, it's their spirit name, basically. And you wouldn't want to insult the animal by saying it out loud.
Okay.
And what happens in, you know, migrations of humans and conquests and so forth is that the spirit names and the common names get mixed up. And there's a strange drift away from what was originally intended to be named to, you know, to what is named today. So, you know, and so taxonomists try and be more careful. You know, they'll look and say at a fish, and they'll say, you know, if it has five spines,
like persiform,
salmonidae, whatever, and you know, there's a whole process of, you know, doing these cladograms, which, you know, show you where a fish lands.
Yeah.
But to get back to this word bass, it turns out that bass is really, it's just a human perception name that has almost nothing to do with taxonomy whatsoever.
Okay.
I have come across 7 or 8 different taxonomic orders with fish in them that are commonly called bass.
Right.
So, you know, I think, Bernie, when you and I first met at the Hudson River, was it you that were speaking about the black sea bass? And I mean, you'd been out on a party boat recently. So Bernie had seen, you had seen the cover of my book, and the fish that represents the bass on the on my book is a fish called the European sea bass.
European sea bass, right.
And but it, on the cover it just says bass. And Bernie had just got gotten back from a fishing trip out of Point Lookout, right?
No, it was somebody else, but
it was somebody else.
Yeah, but I looked at the cover and I said, you know, this isn't our local black sea bass.
Right. You said this is
catch
not
all the time.
Exactly. And yeah. And you know, it turns
out a striped bass.
Or a striped bass. And so, you know, if you look at all these fish that we call bass, you know, the black sea bass, right? The striped bass, the European sea bass, the Chilean sea bass, California white sea bass. These fish have as much to do with each other taxonomically as I have to do with, say, a lemur.
Hmm.
You know, we're lemur, you know, we have four appendages and, you know, bifocal vision and five digits.
I have an uncle, though, that looks like a lemur, so I don't know about that.
He's the missing link?
Yeah, who knows?
Well, anyway, so what I realized more than anything else that bass was, for most consumers, it was a flesh archetype. You know, and I also, you know, I went to college at Brown in the 80s, and I studied semiotics, right? And so, you know, we talk about, in semiotics, about a signifier. You know, there's the signifier and the signified. There's the word and the thing that it actually represents in the minds of people, and that can be different who you talk to. But if you're talking about sort of generally fish-ignorant people, they hear the word sea bass, and they what comes to mind is a whitish piece of fish that's not too flaky, that's substantial enough to broil, and that is the archetype. And what has happened is that we have, once that flesh archetype was established in our minds, we have looked all over the world to fill that archetype with different species that fit that sort of flavor category.
Well, the other thing is if you say to me bass, I immediately think of the black sea bass that we catch here.
Sure.
And somebody in Europe would think of
the European
sea bass.
That's right.
And somebody in the Mediterranean may not.
Right, but at the end of the day, those fish in fillet form, most of the time...
They all look the same.
Most of the time will get you by. I mean,
nice, white, firm, flaky fish.
That's right. You know, a firmer thing than a cod.
Right.
And just for people who are wondering, what is the origin of the word bass? So it does seem to... Anatoly Lieberman, the linguist I spoke with, traced it back. And it seems to go back to the German Barsch, which means spine, comes from spines, and it seems to be that it's a fish, a bass is basically a spiny thing, something with spines on the back. That's
all right.
Anyway,
but the names of it, like Loup de mer,
right?
And
yeah, well,
those
so,
other names.
Yeah, well, it. so you know, yeah. we're of course talking in an Anglophonic context.
Yeah.
In other cultures, what's interesting to note, and what I go into in the book, is that you know the other iconic name that the European sea bass is known by is Branzino.
Right.
And that sort of struck me as sort of interesting moment was that suddenly we started seeing Branzino all over
the
place.
All over the place. You go to every restaurant now, they have Branzino.
And they have Branzino.
And it's a fine fish. It's good.
And it always looks very fresh. And you're like, well, where is this fish from? Well, so it turns out that the Branzino is the European sea bass. And I realized that by tracking the arrival of the European sea bass on American shores and in American markets, that there was an interesting story that was somewhat of picking up where the salmon left off.
Mm.
So if the salmon story is really about, you know, was about the loss of this northern, very northern
That's
fish.
That's a local fish, really.
That was a local fish.
Yeah.
Bass, the story of bass is the loss of a whole bunch of fish.
Mm.
And so what I noticed in looking around is that in the 70s and 80s, we start to have the real serious coastal fisheries crises. And we start to lose a series of different fish called bass. So you'll remember, you know, the American striped bass. We start to have real declines in the 70s and 80s. Out on the West Coast, there's a fish called the California white sea bass, which also goes into very serious decline in the 70s and 80s. When those fish start to decline, people start slotting in a fish that was once known only as the Patagonian toothfish.
Mm.
But then we rebranded that as the Chilean sea bass.
Yeah, nobody's going to buy the toothfish.
That's right. I mean, it's funny because when I first started looking into the sea bass issue, I did a story for the New York Times about Chilean sea bass. And when I tell people I was working on the Chilean sea bass story, they said, oh, I know that story. That's the story where they swapped the real bass with that not real bass. And I go, well, you know, that's kind of true. But then I go, well, what is the real bass?
Yeah,
silence.
That's
and the issue is there is no real bass. There are many different fish. Anyway, so, you know, we have decline in the 80s of the striped bass. European, California white sea bass. And meanwhile, in the Mediterranean, they had progressive declines of their bass, the European sea bass. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that brought about that was, I don't know, you struck me as somebody who's traveled a fair amount. You remember in the 70s when the colonels were deposed from Greece.
Greece. Yeah.
And suddenly Greece opened up, right? And they had all these tourist packages where everyone was flying to Greece, you know, and you'd stay in the great little pension and go to the taverna. And what happens when you go to the taverna? The guy says, well, would you like a fish?
Right.
Would you like a nice whole fish, right? And that's the iconic Greek meal. Well, turns out that whole fish quite often was the European sea bass, also known as the branzino. In Greek, it's called lavraki, which means the clever one.
Oh, okay. That's where the name Luc de Mer came from,
Wolf
of the sea?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's something all the Mediterranean cultures tend to associate their names with cleverness or wolves.
Right.
And my theory was that whereas in the Northern Hemisphere, because the European sea bass is pan-European,
mm-hmm.
and it's off of coastal Germany, England, and so forth, and those waters are a good deal more productive than the waters of the Mediterranean. So, whereas the Germanic peoples called it a bass, barsch, spiny, because that's how they identified it. People in the Mediterranean call it either a wolf of the sea or the clever one. And my feeling is probably not because it's so clever, but because there aren't as many of them.
Yeah, they were hard to catch because their numbers were way down.
They were way down.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so the clever one, the lavraki in Greece, gets even more rare when all these tourists start coming to Greece.
Right.
And there's this much more pressure on these larger fish to be put on that big plate in front of the tourist. So they see huge, huge declines. And that's what spawns the next phase of fish farming. So, you know, salmon are relatively easy to farm because they hatch out of a big egg.
Those big, nice eggs.
They have those nice big eggs. Yeah. They're easy to manipulate. Not a big problem. Sea bass, however, and most of the other fish that we eat hatch out of a very, very tiny egg. And so it turns out that the farming of sea bass, of the European sea bass, is really the next big phase in fish farming. And that's why, you know, that turns out to be a very interesting
that's
story.
That's a terrific story about that Israeli guy Zohar.
Yeah. And so
amazing story. I don't know if I have time to tell the whole thing.
Read the book.
But that's what I was going to say. Read the book. It's a fascinating book. You can see all these great stories and all this science that has gone into this.
Yep.
And the story of Zohar, the Israeli guy who searched for an enzyme to turn on and off the cycle?
Yeah, well, basically, it was many different things had to be figured out.
The problem was what?
Was spawning.
It was spawning,
yep.
Right.
Because they couldn't seem to duplicate the spawning conditions for a sea bass to get them excited enough to spawn. So he actually had to design...
They didn't get him Playboy.
No.
I would have done it. Right?
They didn't have the right models,
right,
you know?
That's it.
What it turned out is that they couldn't replicate the spawning conditions in a tank, and there was no way to get them sort of in the mood, and so that had to be done chemically through an implant. And that implant turns out that they developed for the European sea bass to be a key implant for spawning all kinds of different fish.
So it works for all fish.
The basic framework worked for them, and now it's being applied, say, for bluefin tuna.
Mm.
The reason I chose the European sea bass, you know, was that for many different things, it was what I call a Rosetta Stone fish. So, you know, with Zohar, it led to all these issues of decoding the reproductive system. But there's all this other stuff, which I go into in the book, about trying to figure out how to feed a baby sea bass. Because a baby sea bass, you know, hatches out of a little tiny egg. And it will only eat live food. So you have to figure out what the heck are you going to feed a microscopic creature that will only eat other microscopic creatures.
Yeah, they're not very big. A couple of microns.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's about it.
And so, you know, so that's the other half of the story. It's this, you know, very involved search for trying to figure out. And the thing is, once they figure out how to breed them and once they figure out what they eat, those two factors pretty much allow you to decode the reproduction and the propagation of every single fish in the sea. So, you know, it's this Pandora's box.
Yeah.
You know, the sea bass, you know, it's a Rosetta Stone that leads to a Pandora's box. Because if we can now domesticate anything in the sea, what should we domesticate?
Right. Which one are we going to pick to do?
To be our food, you know.
To be our food.
Yep.
Yeah, so it really is a terrific story with the sea bass. And, you know, as I said, Paul can't tell all the stories or even the full story, but it's like a detective story, that part of it. It's really terrific. And there was something else I wanted to talk to. Oh, yeah, the food conversion ratios.
Yeah, feed conversion.
Yeah, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And that
that's
actually
important in all of the farm-raised or
yeah, and
fish.
You, earlier when we were saying, you know, well, what now that we can decode everything and, right. and grow anything in captivity, what should we grow? Well, this feed conversion issue is actually a major question. Feed conversion is basically the amount of pounds of feed you need to produce a pound of edible flesh. And, you know, where this why this is relevant in many places is that what do we feed fish on the farm? Well, other fish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the early days of salmon farming, it could take as many as 6 pounds of fish to make a single pound of salmon.
We're talking about small fish like anchovies, sardines, capelin, and
yep.
things like that.
Yep. And right. so you really have this potential if you're going to boost aquaculture production up to the level. If you're trying to get to a point, which we are, by the way, where now half of our fish are farmed.
Right.
You really run the risk of pulling the rug out from underneath the marine ecosystem, because if we're grinding up the bottom of the food chain to feed fish in captivity at the top of the food chain, it's a real problem. So what the fish that we should be looking to domesticate should be the ones that are the most efficient. And there are efficient choices out there,
yeah.
But we don't necessarily choose them because we have this branding in our mm-hmm. head of what it is that we think is delicious.
Yeah. So that's the problem. One of the problems.
That is one of the problems.
Yeah. Do you know that Zohar get a... did he patent this process, or did he?
I think he did patent the implants. Yeah,
the implants. So he must be doing well now.
You know, he's a professor in Maryland. Yeah. He's you know, he's a very very good scientist, and like many good scientists, I think he's much more interested
in the research
and the results than necessarily. But he's doing all kinds of stuff. He's doing stuff with blue crab now.
Good.
You know, and he's considered sort of a go-to guy when fish are having problems getting it on.
Yeah.
He calls himself the Dr. Ruth of the sea.
Oh, that's good. So when you do your next book, you're yeah. going to put blue crabs in it too.
I may do. You know, I'm looking at a lot at oysters, and mm-hmm. I'm looking a lot at shrimp. Mm-hmm. But it just sort of depends, is there a good story? Because, you know, I don't know if you know Carl Safina, but
yeah.
Fantastic right. naturalist and whatever, and,
right.
you know, MacArthur Genius Grant winner, but he once said to me, people don't want to read about fish, they want to read about people. So in order for me to write about a fish, I got to find a good person attached to it.
That's true, yeah. Like Mark Kurlansky.
Sure.
His book was
Cod. Cod.
You mentioned it. I love that book, too.
Yep.
And the book on oysters.
Yep. And
the Big Oyster.
The Big Oyster, fantastic book.
That was a great book also.
Yep.
That's a real history book in New
yeah,
York City.
Yeah, and Mark made a very conscious decision with his oyster book. You know, it's really a story of the characters. There's more about Dickens sometimes than there is
right.
about oysters.
When he comes to New York for dinner.
Yeah.
yeah. That's great. So I think about 30 seconds, Jack? Okay, so we're going to wind this up now. This is the end of our first show. Paul came down, and we're going to do another show that will be on in the future. And we're going to wrap up this show now. I want to thank Paul for coming in.
Thanks, Bernie.
And stay tuned in the future, because in a couple of weeks, you'll hear part two, which is just as exciting as part one. We talk about the adventures of tuna and
cod.
And cod. And, you know, cod. Wow, if you grew up in New England, cod is everything. So it's a great story. So keep tuned in and look at the photo gallery. You'll see a picture of the cover of the book and a great picture of Paul the fisherman.
I like to be under the sea. In an octopus's garden in the shade,
we would be warm below the storm.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.